The Pain Pod's presented by Trumeau Pharmaceuticals and is intended for educational and informational purposes only. Please speak to medical professionals before making any treatment decisions. And visit TrumeauRx.com to learn more about their work. Oh, and I'm Natalie Lynch, your host for this episode of The Pain Pod.
There's no such thing as real or unreal pain.
Pain doesn't know gender or culture or anything, right? It afflicts us all.
Because it affects so many people in often profound ways.
You know, you do a lot of thinking when you're in pain. I think it gives you a certain perspective on life.
Definitely did not want to accept it, and I also didn't believe that that was really the plan for my life.
I always get through it, though. Always.
Hi, my name is Ignacio Variola. I'm an anesthesiologist and chronic pain physician at the University of Pennsylvania.
In episode 2, we left off hearing much about the relationship between pain and the brain and how what we might call physical or biological pain interacts with our psychological and emotional health. We pick up here with anesthesiologist Dr. Badiola speaking to exactly that.
What we see is as chronic pain becomes chronic, there's a higher percentage of people that have an associated anxiety or depression. And a lot of what, you know, we end up seeing is when we see patients is they're still under the notion that, you know, they're making up their pain and that's what we think, that we're all blaming it on psychological aspects. But what we do know is that that the anxiety and the depression can actually make the pain experience worse. And, you know, some of us have kind of been down the line where we have even an acute pain problem. And if we become anxious of it, we feel that pain a little bit more. So what we tend to do is not only treat the biological aspect of the actual pain from the area where they've been injured, but again, because pain is a perception, changing the way that specific patient feels the pain can be done using some psychological techniques. Our dedicated pain psychologists, which actually help, treat the associated anxiety and depression, which can make that experience worse for that specific patient. We try to dispel the notion that because they have chronic pain, we think it's due to their psychological makeup. But it's the other way around, where anxiety and depression may be actually making the pain experience worse.
There's a whole faction now of medicine that's just about pain management. Don't get me wrong, I've been there, I've been in pain, but I've also successfully gotten out of it. My name is Dr. Ben Ozan, and I practice in Fayetteville, Arkansas, the natural state, and I've been a chiropractor for almost 10 years. I feel like we've been just told that it's a part of our life, and so that's the mindset that many people get into is, let me just figure out how I can manage my pain and get on with my life. And I'm not a mental health expert. I'm not, you know, a psychiatrist, a psychologist. So I leave that up to their expertise. But if we can start speaking to that and start helping them to see the positivity, and probably the biggest subluxation, which is, you know, in our profession, the big focus that we deal with when it comes to the spine. But we say the biggest subluxation that people deal with is the one between their ears. If you can overcome the mental aspect and start to change your outlook, that is the first step, if not one of the most important steps, to actually then getting healthy.
Yes, a lot of patients don't know that. And a lot of them have been brought up through the medical system over the years. And it's gotten better over the last few years. But, you know, going back into the 70s, 80s, 90s, where somebody couldn't figure out where their pain was coming from, you know, all of a sudden the patient was making that symptom up. And some patients still are under that notion, and, you know, going through some care physicians who may not really understand the pain, and they've gone through multiple specialists, nobody can find the specific reason why they're having pain. You know, we do testing and they do have anxiety and depression, and to kind of bring that up sometimes is a little bit difficult. And so in terms of how they receive it, it depends on how the pain physician brings it up with them. it does take some time to sit down and kind of approach that subject and try to kind of educate the patient rather than, you know, kind of spewing it out in that one visit. Sometimes it takes a few visits, but to kind of, you know, show that compassion to them and kind of try to at least educate them. But even then, it's still, you know, kind of wired into our culture. A lot of patients come in and they have that fear that, you know, we're all just kind of blame it on anxiety and depression. So I think a lot of it is education.
If anything, the resistance that I get is, yeah, it's just the belief that, can I actually get better? Like, because they've been told for so long, this is just a fact. It's a part of your life. We're going to help you manage this. And then here you have a doctor saying, no, you could have so much more. You could be so much more. You've been called to so much more, and you have the ability to heal, that some people just, like, they get shut down because all of their life, or for so many years, they've been told the opposite.
Dr. Ozan and Dr. Badiola both appreciate the interconnectedness of physical pain with the brain, and with anxiety, depression, and pain amplification. But would they agree with some of what we heard in the previous episode, that tension myoneural syndrome, or TMS, the name of a mind-body condition coined by Dr. John Sarno, would they agree that a TMS-based approach to pain may be the key to curing it?
Cured? I don't think so. Do I think it's a modality that helps treat the symptom, just like insulin helps diabetics, but it's not specifically helping or curing your diabetes? The evidence is hit or miss on it, you know, but there's a lot of, you know, confounding that goes on in some of these studies. But it's a relatively benign, meaning that there's not a lot of side effects associated with it. Some patients do benefit from it. And so I do think it's a modality that helps treat the pain. I think it specifically cures pain. I've learned that pain is very individualized, and you can have the same patient, the same condition, in the sense that they both have chronic back pain, the same cause, they have degenerated discs in their lower back. And depending on their culture, depending on how long they've had it, respond completely different to the types of modalities that you throw at them. You know, one may respond really well to interventional procedures, another one may medicines, another one may respond better to things like chiropractic therapy or acupuncture, to try to really individualize, you know, the experience that patient receives and the treatment that patient receives. And it's a little bit hard in the modern medicine, the way we're kind of pushed to see patients every 15 minutes. But, you know, to try to really, if you can, or I've learned to really try to individualize that patient rather than just grouping them under a category of chronic lower back pain, kind of throwing the same thing at everybody with chronic lower back. Pain is multidimensional. We look at their pain condition as a whole. Pain is not just pain the way it used to be thought of. Years ago, where what it was, you know, you put your finger in fire, there's a signal that goes from your finger to your brain telling you that it hurts, and you kind of treat that aspect of it, or what we consider the biological aspect of it. With chronic pain, especially as the years go on and that specific person experiences that pain, there's a whole lot of other issues that become involved, including psychological issues, anxiety, depression's highly associated with chronic pain states. And so a lot of it is trying to treat that aspect of it, and not just the biological of it. So what we try to do as chronic pain physicians, and I think in general we're well equipped to do, is to kind of look at the whole pain condition, including some of the psychological aspects, and try to treat that part of it as well. In my experience, if that area of pain doesn't get treated or evaluated, it's very hard to treat the actual pain.
I first experienced probably my biggest bout of pain when I was a junior in high school. I was in a pretty significant car accident, totaled my car. Thankfully, me and the other two passengers were able to walk away. But now having kind of that hindsight and looking back on my life, I've recognized that since that accident, I steadily started to deal with headaches, migraines. Got to the point that I was dealing with them probably 5 to 6 days a week in some severity. And then also started developing lower back pain. So from my junior year, as I got older, got in college, things got really pretty bad. And there'd be times where, you know, if I had a migraine, my day was done. So I would just have to go lay down and go to bed. Like, didn't matter what time of day it was, couldn't focus, concentrate. I just kind of had resigned myself to, hey, you know, I'm going to have pain. I hadn't even thought of chiropractic necessarily as a solution for my pain. I grew up in a medical household, so I thought my solution was, hey, everyone deals with headaches. Everyone deals with lower back pain. It's just kind of a reality of life. When you have one, just pop a pill. If you need to, go to sleep and then just go on with your life. My dad being a spinal surgeon, I actually wanted to go into healthcare since, you know, I was, you know, probably 12 or 13. My girlfriend, who's now my wife, turned me on to chiropractic. She's like, hey, you know what? You should check out chiropractic and see if that's a good fit for you versus going to medical school. And so I started talking to different, you know, different chiropractors, different doctors, and figured out that, you know, the lifestyle, the philosophy, was something that I was really passionate about, especially the fact that, you know, the focus is on prevention and helping people get healthy and well versus waiting until they've gotten to that point of no return where surgery is kind of their last option. And so that was the path that I wanted to take on. And as I got into school, I realized that it was like, hey, these headaches and lower back pain that I've been dealing with since I was in high school, they're not normal. And in fact, there's something that, especially with chiropractors, we see great results in getting corrected.
Dr. Badiola and Dr. Ozan agree, TMS is valuable, but good pain treatment is holistic and individualized. TMS isn't the answer, it's a tool. I wonder if they view cannabis similarly.
So I have a pretty big opinion on cannabis. I do think overall it's overhyped. I know that chronic pain is probably the most common reason at least medical cannabis is quote unquote prescribed across the United States. The evidence for pain. So when I talk to patients, we do, you know, patients come in and they read all these things on the internet that it helps with pain and this and that. I hate to all kinds of chronic pain under one umbrella. There's subtypes of different kinds of pain. So for example, there's a type of pain called neuropathic pain, which is nerve pain. So this to injuries and this in the nervous system, nerve injuries, things like diabetic neuropathy, where there's actual nerve injury in the hands and the feet from the high blowers. The evidence for marijuana for that tends to be relatively decent. So I would say mild to modest. Again, based on you know, evidence that's somewhat lacking because of the regulatory status of marijuana in the United States, where it's just very hard to study. There's other types of pain which doesn't seem to respond as well. Somatic pain, so pain from things like lower back pain, just chronic lower back pain, achy back type of thing, where it doesn't tend to help as much. On the individual level, there's some patients that do have back pain that do submit, and you know, they're willing to try it out. They try it and they come back and say it's helped more than things like the opioids that I've been on, the anti-inflammatories that I've been on. If you look at the studies, it seems to help more modestly in neuropathic pain conditions than it does in some other chronic pain conditions. But again, you know, it's different when you look at a study where it's dealing with hundreds of patients, and even in the study, there's going to be some patients that benefit from it. And so we just need better evidence to suggest it. But in general, it does seem to help some chronic pain states.
It's kind of that hot topic now, like, oh, cannabis this and cannabis that and CBD oil. I think a lot of that's going to die down in another couple of years. I think it's a great alternative to pain medications, and they've shown that the side effects of doing cannabis or CBD oil are significantly less than taking, for example, an opioid. So I think it's a great, like, hey, all right, you've been in chronic pain. Why don't we try this? I'm grateful that it's starting to become mainstream, and I think it's something that people should pursue if they've been in chronic pain, but it shouldn't be where the buck stops. It should be the first step to, all right, I've been on opioids, let me help wean myself off of those and get on cannabis, and now I'm in a better state of mental and well-being that I can now start to take care of other aspects of my health, eating healthy, exercising, taking care of my spine, my nervous system, and really truly getting a whole health and well-being back to my body.
The ability to wean off of or avoid opioids was something both doctors referenced in outlining the potential benefits of marijuana. And the news has been littered with negative stories about opioids in the last number of years. It begs the question, do opioids still have a role to play in treating pain?
So I do think they do play a role. I don't think they play a role as what we used to think last 20, 30 years, especially in the 90s, where it's used kind of cranked up, where the answer was basically, if you have pain, you give somebody opioids, healing until they stop breathing. And I think that, you know, what we found is that there is a ceiling in terms of pain relief. So you can keep cranking the dosages up, and that increases the risk of side effects, but the pain level kind of tapers off. And so the answer is not to just keep giving somebody more opioids. And I think that in general, opioids do play a part, just like some other medicines may play a part. And so the way, you know, we've kind of, or a lot of people are practicing chronic pain at the time, is to use something called a multimodal approach. Includes, you know, treating pain using various modalities. Opioids are one of those modalities. And although, you know, people that have, you know, addiction problems, those are a little bit higher risk, and they may not be worth adding opioids in their regimen and instead using other medicines. But in general, I do think that right patient, opioids may still be indicated. And the whole notion of nobody on chronic pain should get opioids, I don't really believe that. I do think do play a part, just not a great of a part that they used to play over the last 30 years.
Our bodies aren't perfect, but there's that point of no return. There's permanent issues. So I really truly believe that there are a small percentage of people out there that unfortunately, because of where their health has gotten to, they do need help to function on a day in and day out basis. But I think that's a very small percentage. To give you a statistic of how just the crisis that we're in with pain medication, specifically opioids, we make up a little less than 5% of the world's population. And we consume over 80% of the world's opioids in the US. Crazy. Like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, all right, we make up a very small percentage, and yet we're taking the majority of the painkillers. And even like hydrocodone, we consume 99% of the global hydrocodone supply. And then in the US, 2/3 of the world's illegal drugs. So like, not only are we consuming like prescription medications, but because of just our lifestyle and what these prescription meds lead to, we also then consume 2/3 of the world's illegal drugs. Thank you. all in all, in the United States, like, we're doped up. We consume way too much medication, and it's caused a crisis to the point that over 130 people die every day of opioid overdose. Do I think there's a time and a place for it? Yes, but we have to do something drastic to reverse where we're at and the usage that we've gotten into in the United States, because it's not working. And yet, we apparently have the most money, the best healthcare system, the best doctors. So we have a major crisis on our hands, and it boils down to the fact that each person is responsible for their health, and daily taking a medication to numb the pain is not a solution long term.
There's a lot more to say about opioids, and we'll hear directly from people impacted by the drug epidemic in the next episode. But given that Dr. Badiola is a surgical anesthesiologist and pain medicine specialist, and that Dr. Ozan is a chiropractor whose father is a back surgeon, we finish our discussion around tools to treat pain by discussing surgery. When does reducing pain mean having to go under the knife? We hear from experts right after this quick word from our sponsor.
The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and made possible thanks to our sponsor, Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Tremo was founded with the goal of developing and delivering non-opioid pain therapies for people with rare diseases and other select patient conditions. Tremo is currently investigating two COX-2 selective NSAIDs. NSAID, for those who aren't familiar, stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. While neither of these treatments are FDA approved, they are in clinical trials, and you can learn more about those trials, Tremo's mission, and the dedicated team leading it by going to TremoRx.com. That's TremeaURX.com. Tremo, leading the way for those left behind in pain.
As an anesthesiologist, I kind of know at least the perioperative risks that are associated with surgery. If it's somebody who is somewhat active, they're relatively healthy, rather than dumping a whole bunch of medicine to kind of treat the symptoms when surgery may be an option, it may be better just to fix the underlying problem rather than just kind of on the bush with medications. And somebody who's in their 50s or 60s and still has 30 or 40 years to live, and they have something that could be easily fixed. But ultimately, you know, they may be healthy, but they may have an experience where they've had problems with surgery in the past, and they just don't want to have surgery. To let the patient know their options, and if they qualify for both options, to kind of help them kind of guide that decision. As long as the patient knows all their options. And the biggest problem we see is that, for example, as imaging improves, which it has with surgery, is that it's very easy to go after things that show up on imaging. So somebody comes in, they've had chronic back pain, they're in their 50s or 60s, get an MRI, and sure enough, the MRI shows things back there that can be fixed with surgery. The problem is trying to differentiate whether fixing on the MRI is going to make that patient's symptoms any better. And unfortunately, as more and more things on imaging pop up, it may be more difficult to distinguish whether it actually is a pain generator in that specific patient. And a lot of the patients come in with the notion, you know, especially now with electrical records, it's very easy for them to get an MRI. They can see that they have 10 things going on in their MRI. And a lot of the times it's just educating them that, you know, we can take people that are old who have never had a day of back pain in their lives, get imaging, and all of them are going to have changes on their MRI. And so a lot of people are not aware of that. So a lot of that is educating.
So there was a study done in 2018 in the Internal Medicine Journal. And what they looked at was, okay, when should you pursue, for example, lower back surgery? And one of the most common types of lower back surgeries is a spinal fusion. So that's in instances where someone's had, you know, a significant arthritic change disc deteriorations, disc herniations, that they feel like the best option for that patient is to actually fuse the segments together. And what they found is that surgery should only be considered, and specifically spinal fusion surgery when it comes to spinal stenosis, should only be considered when alternative conservative treatments have failed for up to 6 months. So basically what that means is if someone has not pursued getting things corrected conservatively through chiropractic care, through physical therapy, through even injections, things like that, then they should not even consider having a spinal fusion surgery. And the big reason for that they found was that when you have a spinal fusion surgery, it's expensive, often leads to complications, can require further surgery, increases your risk of mortality. And one of the big ones, it's supposed to fuse the spine to help kind of stabilize it. And a lot of times those surgeries result in failure and lack of fusion in the spine itself. So just even based off the research, not my opinion, surgery should be an absolute last ditch effort where, hey, we've exhausted all of the treatments, all of the therapies, and you know what, this patient hasn't responded to any of them. Now it's time to do surgery. And unfortunately in our society, that's not what happens. You know, they'll maybe do an injection here, maybe do a month or two of PT, and then when that fails, all right, we're gonna do surgery. So I think there's definitely a time and a place for it, but the percentage of surgeries that are done, especially in America, are way too high, especially based off of the latest literature and research. It should be significantly lower. I especially say that if someone has not pursued consistent care for at least 6 months of actively working on their back through chiropractic, physical therapy, conservative treatments like that, then they shouldn't even consider undergoing the knife yet.
Surgery, like opioids, like marijuana, like chiropractic work, like TMS, has its place in treating pain. It's the size and scope, the frequency with which some of these tools are used, or the degree to which some of these tools are heralded, that's way out of proportion. And the impact that's having is enormous.
It's a moment I'm never going to forget. I got the message from this man on Facebook saying he was my brother's landlord and to please give him a call. And so the thought crossed my mind, like, oh my gosh, what happened to David?
That's Alyssa Klein. 4 weeks ago, she lost her brother to an overdose. We'll speak to Alyssa and others about the impact of the opioid epidemic and where the healthcare system is failing on episode 4 of The Pain Pod. The Pain Pod is written and directed by Patrick James Lynch, produced and edited by Greg Holdsman, artwork by Ryan Gielen and Christina Newhard, post-production support from Joshua Sterling Bragg, Rob Bradford, and Avra Friedman. And this episode was hosted by me, Natalie Lynch. The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and presented by Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Learn more about Tremo and the work they're doing to help alleviate pain by visiting TREMEAURX.com. Subscribe, rate, and share The Pain Podcast. Referrals from you are the best way we can reach new people. Thanks for listening. My name's Natalie Lynch, and we'll be back next week with episode 4 of The Pain Pod.